So today we're continuing our story on Mahosattha, the great sage, the Bodhisattva. And where we left off where the armies of 101 kings with the king of Uttarapanchala. They were defeated by Mahosattha's great wisdom and his foresight in being very well prepared for their attack. And they have run away, and they left behind all of their treasure. And so we're going to start with a paragraph closing off the episode of the battle at Videha. So after the soldiers and the whole army ran in rout, then the next morning, the soldiers of the city of Videha opened the city gates and went forth, and seeing the great booty, and the great treasure that was left over, they reported it to the great being, asking what they were to do. He said, "The goods which they have left are ours. Give to our king that which belonged to the princes, and bring to me that which belonged to Kevatta and the other private persons. All the rest let the citizens take." It took half a month to remove the jewels of price and valuable goods, 4 months for the rest. The great being gave great honor to Anu Kevatta. From that day the citizens of Mithila had plenty of gold. Now Brahmadatta and those kings had been a year in the city of Uttarapanchala, when one day Kevatta, looking upon his face in a mirror, saw the scar on his forehead. This is the scar that he got when the Bodhisattva tricked him into bowing down to pick up the gem and then ground his head into the ground, giving him a scar on his forehead. And he looked at the scar on his forehead and thought, "That is the doing of the farmer's son. He made me a laughing stock before all those kings." Anger arose in him. "How can I manage to see his back?" Apparently, "see his back" is a way of saying, "How can I get back at him?" He thought, "Ah, here is a plan. Our king's daughter, Panchala Chandi, is peerless in beauty, like a divine nymph. I will show her to King Videha. He will be caught by desire like a fish that has swallowed the hook. I will land him and Mahosattha with him and kill them both and drink the cup of victory." With this resolved, he approached the king. "My lord," said he, "I have an idea." "Yes, teacher, your idea left me once without a rag to cover me. What will you do now? Hold your peace." "Sire, there never was a plan equal to this." "Speak on then," the king replied. "Sire, we too must be alone." "So be it." The Brahmin took him into an upper story and said, "Great king, I will attract King Videha by desire to bring him here and kill him."
"A good plan, teacher, but how are we to arouse his desire?"
"Sire, your daughter Panchala Chandi is peerless in beauty. We will have her charms and accomplishments celebrated in verse by poets, and have these poems sung in Mithila. When we find that he is saying to himself, 'If the mighty monarch Videha cannot get this pearl of maidens, what is his kingdom to him?' We'll have him saying to himself, 'If he can't get it, what is his kingdom?' And that he is caught in the attraction of the idea, I will go and fix a day. On the day fixed by me, he will come, like a fish that has swallowed the hook, and the farmer's son with him. Then we will kill them." This pleased the king, and he agreed. "A fine plan that, my teacher, so we will do." But a minor bird that watched the king's bed took note of it. Many people are wondering why these birds are able to understand the human speech. And just as a side note, I'd like to say that I have students of mine who claim to be able to understand the speech of birds. When I was conducting a meditation course in Los Angeles, they were able to
they came and told me, they said, oh, they've been listening to what the birds are saying about all the meditators, and they're gossiping and saying nasty things about the meditators. So I wouldn't be quite sure that this isn't fact and actually true, that these birds were able to understand and listen. And so the king sent for clever poets and paid them richly and showed them his daughter, bidding them make a poem on her beauty. And they made songs of exceeding great sweetness and recited them to the king. He rewarded them richly. Musicians learnt these songs from the poets and sang them in public, and thus they were spread abroad. When they had been spread abroad, the king sent for the singers and said, my children, climb into the trees by night with some birds, sit there and sing, and in the morning tie bells about their necks, let them fly and come down. This he did, that the world might say, the very gods sing the beauty of the king of Panchala's daughter. Again the king sent for these poets and said to them, my children, make poems to this effect, that such a princess is not for any king in all India save Vaideya king of Mithila, praising the king's majesty and the girl's beauty. They did so and reported it. The king paid them well and told them to go to Mithila and sing in the same way. The poets and singers went to Mithila singing these songs on the way, and there sang them in public. Crowds of people heard the songs, and amidst loud applause paid them well. At night they would climb into the trees and sing, and in the morning tied bells about the birds' necks before they came down. People heard the sound of the bells in the air, and all the city rang with the news that the very gods were singing the beauty of the king's daughter. The king, hearing of it, sent for the poets and made an audience in his palace. He was to think that they wanted to give him the peerless daughter of King Julani, so he paid them well, and they came back and told Brahmadatta. Then Kevata said to him, now, sire, it is time for me to go and settle the day. Very good, teacher, what must you take with you? A little present. The king gave a present. Kevata went with it, accompanied by a large following, to King Vaideya's kingdom. On his arrival being made known, all the city was in an uproar. King Julani and Vaideya, they say, will strike a friendship. Julani will give his daughter to our king, and Kevata, they say, is coming to fix a day. King Vaideya also heard this, and the great being heard it, and thought, I like not his coming. I must find out about it exactly. So he sent word to spies that lived with Julani. They replied, we do not quite understand this business. The king and Kevata were sitting and talking in the royal bedchamber, but the Mina bird which watches the bedchamber will know about it. On hearing this, the great being thought, that our enemies may not have an advantage, I will parcel out the whole city and decorate it, and not allow Kevata to see it. So from the city gate to the palace, and from the palace to his own house, on both sides of the road, he erected lattice work and covered all over with mats, covered all with pictures, scattered flowers upon the ground, and set jars full of water in place, hung flags and banners. Kevata, as he entered the city, could not see its arrangements. He thought the king had decorated for his sake and did not understand that it had been done that he might not see. When he came before the king, he offered his gift and with a courteous greeting sat down on one side. Then, after an honorable reception, he recited two stanzas to announce the reason of his arrival. A king who wishes for thy friendship sends thee these precious things. Now let worthy sweet-spoken ambassadors come from that place. Let them utter gentle words which shall give pleasure, and let the people of Panchala and Vaideya be one. Sire, he went on, he would have sent another in place of me, but me he sent, feeling sure that no other could tell the tale so pleasantly as I should do. Go, teacher, quoth he, win over the king to look favorably upon it, and bring him back with you. Now, sire, go, and you shall receive an excellent and beautiful princess, and there shall be friendship established between our king and yours. The king was pleased at this proposal. He was attracted by the idea that he should receive a princess of peerless beauty, and replied, teacher, there was a quarrel between you and the wise Mahosada at the Battle of the Law. Now go and see my son. You two wise men must make up your differences, and after a talk together come back. Kevata promised to go and see the sage, and he went. Now the great being that day determined to avoid talking with this man of sin. In the morning drank a little ghee. They smeared the floor with wet cow dung, which is what they use to clean the floors, and smeared the pillars with oil. All chairs and seats they removed, except one narrow couch on which he lay. To his servants he gave orders as follows. When the Brahmin begins to talk, say, Brahmin, do not talk with the sage. He has taken a dose of ghee today. And when I make as though to talk with him, stop me, saying, My lord, you have taken a dose of ghee. Do not talk. After these instructions, the great being covered himself with a red robe. Ghee, of course, is some sort of clarified butter that is a purgative, I think. The great being covered himself with a red robe and lay down on his couch after posting men at the seven gate towers. Kevata, reaching the first gate, asked where the wise man was. Then the servants answered, Brahman, do not make much noise. If you wish to go in, go silently. Today the sage has taken ghee, and he cannot stand a noise. At the other gates they told him the same thing. When he came to the seventh gate, he entered the presence of the sage, and the sage made as though to speak. But he said, My lord, do not talk. You have taken a strong dose of ghee. Why should you talk with this wretched Brahmin? So they stayed him. The other came in, but could not find where to sit, nor a place to stand by the bed. He passed over the wet cow dung and stood. Then one looked at him and rubbed his eyes. One lifted his eyebrow. One scratched his elbow. When he saw this, he was annoyed and said, Why, sir, I am going. Another said, Ha, wretched Brahmin, don't make a noise. If you do, I'll break your bones for you. Terrified, he looked back when another struck him on the back with a bamboo stick. Another caught him up by the throat and pushed him. Another slapped him on the back until he departed in fear, like a fawn from the panther's mouth, and returned to the palace. Now the king thought, Today my son will be pleased to hear the news. What a talking there will be between the two wise men about the law. This is the Dharma, about the truth. Today they will be reconciled together, and I shall be the gainer. So when he saw Kevata, he recited a stanza asking about their conversation together. How did your meeting with Mahosada come off, Kevata? Pray tell me that. Was Mahosada reconciled? Was he pleased? To this Kevata replied, Sire, you think that is a wise man, but there is not another man less good. And he recited a stanza as well. He is a man of ignoble nature, lord of men. Disagreeable, obstinate, wicked in disposition, like one dumb or deaf, he said not a word. This displeased the king, but he found no fault. He provided Kevata and his attendants with all that they needed and a house to live in, and bade him go and rest. After he had sent him away, the king thought to himself, My son is wise and knows well how to be courteous. Yet he would not speak courteously to this man and did not want to see him. Surely he must have seen cause for some apprehension in the future. And he composed a stanza of his own. Verily, this resolution is hard to understand. A clear issue has been foreseen by this strong man. Therefore, my body is shaken. Who shall lose his own and fall into the hands of his foe? No doubt my son saw some mischief in the Brahmin's visit. He will have come here for no friendly purpose. He must have wished to attract me by desire and make me go to his city and there capture me. The sage must have foreseen some danger to come. As he was turning over these thoughts in his mind with alarm, the four wise men came in. The king said to Senaka, Well, Senaka, do you think I ought to go to the city of Uttara Panchala and marry King Julani's daughter? He replied, Oh, sire, what is this you say? When luck comes your way, who would drive it off with blows? If you go there and marry her, you will have no equal save Julani Brahmadatta in all India, because you will have married the daughter of the chief king. The king knows that the other princes are his men, and Vaideha alone is his peer, and so desires to give you his peerless daughter. Do as he says, and we also shall receive dresses and ornaments. When the king asked the others, they all said the same. And as they were conversing, Brahman Kevata came from his lodging to take his leave of the king and go. And he said, Sire, I cannot linger here. I will go, prince of men. The king showed him respect and let him go. When the great being heard of his departure, he bathed and dressed and went to wait on the king, saluting him, and sat on one side. Thought the king, Wise Mahosada, my son, is great and full of resource. He knows past, present, and future. He will know whether I ought to go or not. Yet, befooled by passion, he did not keep to his first resolve, but asked his question in a stanza. All six have one opinion, and they are sages supreme in wisdom. To go or not to go, to abide here, Mahosada, tell me your opinion also.
At this, the sage thought, "This king is exceedingly greedy in desire, blind and foolish. He listens to the words of these four. I will tell him the mischief of going and dissuade him." So he repeated four stanzas. "Do you know, great king, mighty and strong is King Julani Brahmadatta, and he wants you to kill, as a hunter catches the deer by decoy, as a fish greedy for food does not recognize the hook hidden in the bait, or a mortal his death. So you, O king, greedy in desire, do not recognize Julani's daughter, you mortal, your own death. Go to Panchala, and in a little time you will destroy yourself, as a deer caught on the road comes into great danger." At this heavy rebuke, the king was angry. "The man thinks I am his slave," he thought. "He forgets that I am king. He knows that the chief king has sent to offer me his daughter, and says not a word of good wishes, but foretells that I shall be caught and killed like a silly deer, or a fish that swallows the hook, or a deer caught on the road." And immediately he recited a stanza. "I was foolish, I was deaf and dumb, to consult you on high matters. How can you understand things like other men when you grew up hanging on to the plowtail?" Amazing, after all this time, that he's still able to come up with these words. With these opprobrious words, he said, "This clodhopper is hindering my good luck. Away with him." And to get rid of him, he uttered this stanza. "Take this fellow by the neck and rid my kingdom of him who speaks to hinder my getting a jewel." But he, seeing the king's anger, thought, "If anyone at the bidding of this king sees me by hand or by neck or touch me, I shall be disgraced to my dying day. Therefore I will go myself." So he saluted the king and went to his house. Now the king had merely spoken in anger, but out of respect for the bodhisattva, he did not command anyone to carry out his words. Then the great being thought, "This king is a fool. He knows not his own profit or unprofit. He is in love and determined to get that princess. He does not perceive the danger to come. He will go to his ruin. I ought not to let his words lie in my mind. He is my great benefactor and has done me great honor. I must have confidence in him. But first I will send the parrot and find out the facts. Then I will go myself." So he sent the parrot. To explain this, the Buddha said, and this is again the Buddha telling this story, so this is the Buddha gives an explanation. "Then he went out of Vedaya's presence and spake to his messenger, Matara, the clever parrot. Come, my green parrot, do a service for me. The king of Panchala has a Maina bird that watches his bed. Ask him in full, for he knows all the secret of the king of Nkosia." Matara, the clever parrot, listened and went, the green parrot, to the Maina bird. Then this clever parrot, Matara, spake to the sweet-voiced Maina in her fine cage. "Is all well with you in your fine cage? Is all happy, O Vesa? Do they give you parched honey corn in your fine cage?" "All is well with me, sir. Indeed, all is happy. They do give me parched honey corn, O clever parrot." "Why have you come, sir, and why were you sent? I never saw or heard of you before." On hearing this, he thought, "If I say I am come from Mithila, for her life she will never trust me. On my way, I noticed the town Aritapura in this kingdom of Sivi. So I will make up a false tale how the king of Sivi has sent me hither." And he said, "I was King Sivi's chamberlain in his palace, and from thence that righteous king set the prisoners free from bondage." Then the Maina gave him the honey corn and the honey water, which stood ready in her golden dish, and said, "Sir, you have come a long way. What has brought you?" He made up a tale, desirous to learn the secret, and said, "I once had a wife as a sweet-voiced Maina bird, and a hawk killed her before my eyes." Then she asked, "But how did the hawk kill your wife?" He told her this story. "Listen, madam. One day our king invited me to join him at a water party. My wife and I went with him and amused ourselves. In the evening we returned with him to the palace. To dry our feathers, my wife and I flew out of a window and sat on top of the pinnacle. At that moment, a hawk swooped down to catch us as we were leaving the pinnacle. In fear of my life, I flew swiftly off, but she was heavy then, and could not fly fast. Hence, before my eyes, he killed her and carried her off. The king saw me weeping for her loss, and asked me the reason. On hearing what had occurred, he said, 'Enough, friend, do not weep, but look for another wife.' I replied, 'What need I, O Lord, to wed another, wicked and vicious? Better to live alone.' He said, "Friend, I know a bird virtuous like your wife. King Chulani's chamberlain is a minor bird like her. Go and ask her will and let her reply, and if she likes you, come and tell me. Then I or my queen will go with great pomp and bring her back." With these words he sent me, and that is why I am come. And he said, "Full of love for her, I am come to you. If you give me leave, we might dwell together." These words pleased her exceedingly, but without showing her feeling, she said as though unwilling, "Parrot should love parrot and Mina Mina. How can there be a union between parrot and Mina?" The other, hearing this, thought, "She does not reject me. She is only making much of herself. Indeed, she loves me doubtless. I will find some parables to make her trust me." So he said, "Whomsoever the lover loves, be it a low chandala, this is an outcast, all are alike. In love there is no unlikeness." This said, he went on, to show the measure of the differences in birth of men. The mother of the king of Sivi is named Jambavati, and she was the beloved queen consort of Vasudeva the Kanha. Now the king of Sivi's mother, Jambavati, was of the chandala caste, the outcast, and she was the beloved queen consort of Vasudeva, one of the Kanagana clan, the eldest of 10 brothers. The story goes that he one day went out from Dwaravati into the park, and on his way he espied a very beautiful girl standing by the way, as she journeyed on some business from her chandala village to town. He fell in love and asked her birth, and on hearing that she was a chandala, he was distressed, an outcast. Finding that she was unmarried, he turned back at once and took her home, surrounded her with precious things, and made her his chief queen. She brought forth a son, Sibi, who ruled in Dwaravati at his father's death. After giving this example, he went on, "Thus, even a prince such as he mated with a chandala woman, and what of us who are but the animal kingdom? If we like to mate together, then there is no more to be said." And he gave another example as follows. Ratavati, a fairy also, loved Vatcha, and the man loved the animal. In love there is no unlikeness. Fairies are considered to be non-human, so in a sense, animals. But it just means that there's not a human. Vatcha was a hermit of that name, and the way she loved him was this. In times gone by, a Brahmin who had seen the evil of the passions and the defilements left great wealth to follow the ascetic life and lived in the Himavata, this is the Himalayas, in a hut of leaves which he made him. Not far from this hut, in a cave, there lived a number of fairies, and in the same place lived a spider. This spider used to spin his web and crack the heads of these creatures and drink their blood. Now the fairies were timid and weak, the spider was mighty and very poisonous. They could do nothing against him, so they came to the hermit and saluted him, and told him how a spider was destroying them, and they could see no help. Wherefore they begged him to kill the spider and save them, but the ascetic drove them away, crying, "Men like me take no life." A female of these creatures named Rahavati was unmarried, and they brought her all finely arrayed to the hermit and said, "Let her be your handmaiden, and do you slay our enemy." When the hermit saw her, he fell in love and kept her with him, and lay in wait for the spider at the cave's mouth, and as he came out for food, killed him with a club. So he lived with the fairy and begat sons and daughters on her, and then died. Thus she loved him. The parrot, having described this example, said, "Vatcha the hermit, although a man, lived with a fairy who belonged to the animal world. Why should not we do the same, who both are birds?" When she heard him, she said, "My lord, the heart is not always the same. I fear separation from my beloved." But he, being wise and versed in the wiles of women, further tested her with this stanza. "Verily, I shall go away, O sweet-voiced Mina. This is a refusal. No doubt you despise me." Hearing this, she felt as though her heart would break. But before him, she made as though she was burning with newly awakened love and recited a stanza and a half. "No luck for the hasty, O wise parrot Matara. Stay here until you shall see the king, and hear the sound of tabors, and see the splendor of our king." So when evening came, they took their pleasure together, and they lived in friendship and pleasure and delight. Then the parrot thought, "Now she will not hide the secret from me. Now I must ask it of her and go." "Mina," quoth he, you can see this parrot's not a very moral sort of animal. Animals in general are not. "Mina," quoth he, "what is it, my lord?" She replied, "I want to ask you something. Shall I say it?" "Say on, my lord." "Oh, never mind. Today is a festival. Another day I will see about it." If it be suitable to a festival, say it. If not, my lord, say nothing. Indeed, this is a thing fit for a festival day, he replied. Then speak, she said. If you will listen, I will speak. Then he asked the secret in a stanza and a half. This sound so loud heard over the countryside, the daughter of the king of Panchala, bright as a star, he will give her to Videha, and this will be their wedding. When she heard this, she said, my lord, on a festival day you have said a thing most unlucky. The parrot replied, I say it is lucky, you say it is unlucky. What can this mean? I cannot tell you, my lord, she said. Madam, from the time when you refused to tell me a secret which you know, our happy union ends. Importuned by him, she replied, then, my lord, listen. Not even your enemies have such a wedding, Mathura, as there shall be betwixt the kings of Panchala and Videha. Then he asked, why do you ask such a thing, madam? She replied, listen now, and I will tell you the mischief of it. And she repeated another stanza. The mighty king of Panchala will attract Videha, and then he will kill him. His friend she will not be. So she told the whole secret to the wise parrot, and the wise parrot, hearing it, extolled Kewatta. This teacher is a fertile in resource. 'Tis a wonderful plan to kill the king. But what is so unlucky a thing to us? Silence is best. Thus he attained the fruit of his journey, and after passing the night with her, he said, Lady, I would go to the Sivi country and tell the king how I have got a loving wife. And he took her leave in the following words. Now give me leave for just 7 nights, that I may tell the mighty king of Sivi how I have found a dwelling place with a Maina. The Maina hereat, although unwilling to part with him, yet unable to refuse, recited the next stanza. Now I give you leave for 7 nights. If after 7 nights you do not return to me, I see myself gone down into the grave. I shall be dead when you return. The other said, Lady, what is this you say? If I see you not after 7 days, how can I live? So he spake with his lips, but thought in his heart, Live or die, what care I for you? Miserable creature. He rose up, and after flying for a short distance towards the Sivi country, he turned off and went to Mithila. Then descending upon the wise man's shoulder, when the great being had taken him to the upper story and asked him his news, he told him all. The other did him all honor as before. This the master explained as follows. And then Mathura, the wise parrot, said to Mahosadha, This is the story of the Maina. You can see the story is interspersed with a verse and prose. The verse is the original. The prose has been is sort of an explanation of the verses. On hearing it, the great being thought, The king will go, will I, nil I, and if he go, he will be utterly destroyed. And if by bearing a grudge against such a king who gave me such wealth, I refrain from doing well to him, I shall be disgraced. When there is found one so wise as I, why should he perish? I will set out before the king and see Julani, and I will arrange all well, and I will build a city for King Videha to dwell in, and in a smaller passage a mile long and a great tunnel of half a league, and I will consecrate King Julani's daughter and make her king, our king's handmaiden. And even when our city is surrounded by 101 kings with their army of 18 myriads, I will save our king as the moon is saved from the jaws of Rahu. Rahu was this spirit believed to eat the moon when it was in an eclipse, and bring him home. His return is in my hands. As he thought thus, joy pervaded his body, and by force of this joy he uttered this aspiration. A man should always work for his interest in whose house he is fed. Thus bathed and anointed, he went in great pomp to the palace and saluted the king, stood on one side. My lord, he asked, are you going to the city of Uttara Panchala? Yes, my son, if I cannot gain Panchala Chandi, what is my kingdom to me? Leave me not, but come with me. By going thither, two benefits will be mine. I shall gain the most precious of women and make friendship with the king. Then the wise man said, Well, my lord, I will go on ahead and build dwellings for you. Do you come when I send word? Saying this, he repeated two stanzas. Truly, I will go first, Lord of Men, to the lovely city of Panchala's king, to build dwellings for the glorious Videha. When I have built dwellings for the glorious Videha, come, mighty warrior, when I send word. The king, on hearing this, was pleased that he should not desert him, and said, My son, if you go on ahead, what do you want? An army, sire. Take as many men as you wish, my son.
Mahosadha went on, "My lord, have the four prisons opened and break the chains that bind the robbers therein, and send these also with me." "Do as you will, my son," he replied. The great being caused the prisons to be opened and brought forth mighty heroes who were able to do their duty wherever they should be sent, and bade them serve him. He showed great favor to these and took with him 18 companies of men, masons, blacksmiths, carpenters, painters, men skilled in all crafts and arts, with their razor, adzes, spades, hoes, and many other tools. So with a great company he went out of the city. The master explained it by this stanza. The Mahosadha went on ahead to the goodly town of the king of Panchala to build dwellings for Vaideha the Glorious. On his way, the great being built a village at every league's end and left a courtier in charge of each village with these directions. Against the king's return with Panchala Chandi, you are to prepare elephants, horses, and chariots to keep off his enemies and to convey him speedily to Mithila. Arrived at the Ganges bank, he called Anandakumara and said to him, "Ananda, take 300 rights, go to upper Ganges, procure choice timber, build 300 ships, make them cut stores of wood for the town, fill the ships with light wood, and come back soon." Himself in a ship, he crossed over the Ganges, and from his landing place, he paced out the distance, thinking, "This is a league and a half. Here shall be the great tunnel. In this place shall be the town for our king to dwell in. From this place, to the palace, a mile long, shall be the small passage." So he marked out the places and then entered the city. He knew already what he was going to do. He knew already the plan to save his king. And it was involving two tunnels, as we'll see. When King Julani heard of the Bodhisat's coming, he was exceedingly well pleased, for thought he, "Now the desire of my heart shall be fulfilled. Now that he has come, Vaideha will not be long in coming. Then will I kill them both and make one kingdom in all India." All the city was in a ferment. "This, they say, is the wise Mahosadha who put to flight the 101 kings as a crow is scared by a clod." The great being proceeded to the palace gates whilst the citizens gazed at his beauty. Then dismounting from his car, he sent word to the king. "Let him come," the king said. And Mahosadha entered and greeted the king and sat down on one side. Then the king spoke politely to him and asked, "My son, when will the king come?" "When I send for him, my lord." "But why are you come then?" "To build for our king a place to dwell in, my lord." "Good, my son." He gave an allowance for the escort and showed great honor to the great being and allotted him a house and said, "My son, until your king shall come, live here and do not be idle, but do what should be done." But as he entered the palace, he stood at the foot of the stairs, thinking, "Here must be the door of the little tunnel," marking out the spot where the tunnel would end. And again this came to his mind. "The king told me to do for him anything that had to be done. I must take care that this stairway does not fall in while we are digging the tunnel." So he said to the king, "My lord, as I entered, standing by the stair foot and looking at the new work, I saw a fault in the great staircase. If it please you, give me word, and I will make it all right." "Good, my son, do so." He examined the place carefully and determined where the exit of the tunnel should be. Then he removed the stair, and to keep the earth from falling into this place, he arranged a platform of wood, and thus fixed the stair firmly so that it should not collapse. The king, all unwitting, thought this to be done for goodwill to himself. The others spent that day in superintending the repairs, and on the next day he said to the king, "My lord, if I could know where our king is to dwell, I could make it all right and take care of it." "Very good, wise sir. Choose a place for his dwelling where you will live in the city. Accept my palace." "Sire, we are strangers. You have many favorites. If we take their houses, your soldiers will quarrel with us. What are we to do?" "Wise sir, do not listen to them, but choose the place which may please you." "My lord, they will come to you over and over again with complaints, and that will not be pleasant for you. But if you will, let our men be on guard until we take possession of the houses, and they will not be able to get past the door, but will go away. Thus both you and we shall be content." The king agreed. The great being placed his own guards at the foot and head of the stairway, at the great gate everywhere, giving orders that no one was to pass by. Then he ordered his men to go to the queen mother's house and to make as though they would pull it down. When they began to pull down bricks and mud from the gates and walls, the queen mother heard the news and asked, "You fellows, why do you break down my house?"
Mahusada, the sage, wishes to pull it down and to build a palace for his king. If that be so, you may live in this place. Our king's retinue is very large. This place will not do, and we will make a large house for him. You do not know me. I am the queen mother, and now I will go to my son and see about it. We are acting on the king's orders. Stop us if you can. She grew angry and said, Now I will see what is to be done with you, and proceeded to the palace gate. But they would not let her go in. Fellows, I am the king's mother. Oh, we know you, but the king has ordered us to let no one come in. Go away. She was unable to get into the palace and stood looking at her house. Then one of the men said, What are you doing here? Away with you. He seized her by the throat and threw her upon the ground. She thought, Verily, it must be the king's command, otherwise they would not be able to do this. I will visit the sage. She asked him, Son Mahusada, why do you pull down my house? But he would not speak to her. But a bystander said, What did you say, madam? My son, why does the sage pull down my house? To build a dwelling for King Videha. Why, my son, in all this great city, can he find no other place to live in? Take this bribe of 100,000 pieces of money and let him build elsewhere. Very good, madam, we will leave your house alone, but do not tell anyone that you have given this bribe, that no others may wish to bribe us to spare their houses. My son, if it were said that the Queen Mother had need to bribe, the shame would be mine. I shall tell no one. The man consented and took the 100,000 pieces and left that house. Then he went to Kewatta's house, who went to the palace gate but had the skin of his back torn by bamboo sticks. But being unable to get an entrance, he also gave 100,000 pieces. In this way, by seizing houses in all parts of the city and procuring bribes, they got 9 crores, which is, I believe, 90,000, either 90 or 900,000 gold pieces. Could be 9 million even, or 90 million, I can't remember. After this, the great being traversed the whole city and returned to the palace. The king asked him whether he had found a place. Sire, he said, they are all willing to give, but as soon as we take possession, they are stricken with grief. We do not wish to be the cause of unpleasantness. Outside the city, about a mile hence, between the city and the Ganges, there is the place where we could build a palace for our king. When the king heard this, he was pleased. For, thought he, to fight with men inside the city is dangerous. It is impossible to distinguish friend from foe. But without the city, it is easy to fight. Therefore, without the city, I will smite them and kill them. Then he said, Good, my son, build in the place that you have seen. We will, sire. But first your people must not come to the place where we will build in search of firewood or herbs or such like things. If they do, there is sure to be a quarrel, and this will be pleasant for neither of us. Very good, my son, forbid all access on that side. My lord, our elephants are like to disport them in the water. If the water become muddy and the people complain that since Mahusada came we have no clean water to drink, you must put up with it. The king replied, Let your elephants play. Then he proclaimed by beat of drum, Whoever shall go hence to the place where the sage Mahusada is building, he shall be fined 1,000 pieces. Then the great being took leave of the king, and with his attendants went out of the city and began to build a city on the spot that had been set apart. On the other side of the Ganges, the other side of the river, he built a village called Gugali. There he stationed his elephants, horses, and chariots, his kine and oxen. He busied himself with the making of the city and assigned to each their task. Having distributed all the work, he set about making the great tunnel, the mouth of which was upon the Ganges bank. 60,000 warriors were digging the great tunnel. The earth they removed in leather sacks and dropped in the river. This is a tunnel that goes from the river to the city, the new city. And whenever the earth was dropped in, the elephants trampled it underfoot, and the Ganges ran muddy. The citizens complained that since Mahusada had come, they could get no clean water to drink. The river ran muddy, and what was to be done? Then the wise man's spy told him that Mahusada's elephants were playing about in the water and stirring up the mud, and that is why it ran muddy. Now the intentions of the bodhisattvas are always fulfilled. Therefore, in the tunnel, all roots and stones sank into the earth. The entrance to the lesser tunnel was in that city. 700 men were digging at the lesser tunnel. This is the tunnel that goes from the new city to the king's city, to the king's palace. The earth they brought out in leather sacks and dropped in the city, and as they dropped each load, they mixed it with water and built a wall and used it for other works. The entrance into the great tunnel, this is in the new city, the entrance into the great tunnel was in the new city. It was provided with a door 18 hands high, fitted with machinery so that one peg being pressed, all were closed up. Means all doors. On either side, this tunnel was built up with bricks and worked with stucco. It was roofed over with planks and smeared with cement and whitened. In all, there were 80 great doors and 64 small doors, like a mine shaft, sort of, which all by the pressure of one peg closed and by the pressure of one peg opened, a marvelous machinery. On either side, there were some hundreds of lamp cells, also fitted with machinery, so that when one was opened, all opened, and when one was shut, all were shut. On either side were 101 chambers for 101 warriors. In each one was laid a bed of various colors. In each was a great couch, shaded by a white sunshade. Each had a throne near the great couch. Each had a statue of a woman, very beautiful. Without touching them, no one could tell they were not human. Moreover, in the tunnel on either side, clever painters made all manner of paintings. The splendor of Saka, the zones of Mount Sineru, the sea and the ocean, the four continents, Himavat, the Himalayas, Lake Anotata, the Vermilion Mountains, the sun and the moon, the heavens of the four great kings with the six heavens of sense and their divisions, all were to be seen in the tunnel. The floor was strewn with sand, white as a silver plate, and on the roof full-blown lotus flowers. On both sides were booths of all sorts. Here and there hung festoons of flowers and scented blooms. Thus they adorned the tunnel until it was like the divine hall of Sudama. This is the hall of Saka, the king of the angels. Now these 300 wrights, having built 300 ships, freighted them with loads of articles already prepared and brought them down and told the sage. He used them in the city and made them go up the ships, put up the ships in a secret place to bring them out when he should give the word. In the new city, the water moat, the wall, the gate and tower, dwellings for prince and people, elephant stables, tanks, all were finished. So great tunnel and little tunnel and all the city were finished in 4 months. So this is a tunnel connecting the new city with the old city underground, and a larger tunnel going from the new city to the river. If you can picture it. It was hard for me to picture when I first read this. When the king heard this message, he was pleased and set out with a large company. He told the king to come, and the king heard the message. The master said, then the king set out with an army in 4 divisions to visit the prosperous city of Kampiliya with its innumerable chariots. In due time, the king arrived at the Ganges. Then the great being went out to meet him and conducted him to the city which he had built. The king entered the palace and ate a rich meal, and after resting a little, in the evening sent a messenger to King Julani to say that he had come. Explaining this, the master said, then he, on arriving, sent word to Brahmadatta. Mighty king, I am come to salute thy feet. Now give me to wife that woman most beauteous, full of grace, attended by her handmaidens. Julani was very glad at the message and thought, where will my enemy go now? I shall cleave both their heads and drink the cup of victory. But he shewed only joy to the messenger and did him respect and recited the following stanza. Welcome art thou, Videha, a good coming is thine. Inquire now for a lucky hour, and I will give thee my daughter, full of grace, attended by her handmaidens. The messenger now went back to Videha and said, my lord, the king says, inquire for an hour suited to this auspicious event, and I will give you my daughter. He sent the man back, saying, this very day is a lucky hour. The Buddha explained it thus. Then King Videha inquired for a lucky hour, which done, he sent word to Brahmadatta, give me now to wife that woman who's most beauteous, full of grace, attended by her handmaidens. And King Julani said, I give thee now to wife that woman most beauteous, full of grace, attended by her handmaidens. But in saying, I will send her now, even now, he lied. And he gave word to the 101 kings, make ready for battle with your 18 mighty hosts and come forth. We will cleave the heads of our 2 enemies and drink the cup of victory. And he placed in the palace his mother, Queen Talata, and his consort, Queen Nanda, and his son, Panchalachanda, and his daughter, Panchalachandi, with the women, and came forth himself.
The Bodhisattva treated very hospitably the great army which came with King Videha. Some were drinking spirits, some eating fish and flesh, some lay wearied with their long march. But King Videha with Senaka and the other wise men sat on a goodly dais amidst his courtiers. But King Julani surrounded the city in four lines with three intervals, and kindled several hundreds of thousands of torches. And there they stood, ready to take it when the sun should rise. On learning this, the great being gave commission to 300 of his own warriors. Go by the little tunnel and bring in, this is the tunnel between his city and the old city, the king's city, and bring in by that tunnel the king's mother and consort, his son and daughter. Take them through the great tunnel, but do not let them out by the door of the great tunnel. Keep them safe in the tunnel until we come. But when we come, bring them out of the tunnel and place them in the great court. When they had received these commands, they went along the lesser tunnel and pushed up the platform beneath the staircase that the Bodhisattva had prepared in the king's palace, seized the guards at the top of the, and bottom of the staircase and on the terrace, the humpbacks and all the others that were there, bound them hand and foot, gagged them and hid them away here and there, ate some of the food prepared for the king, destroyed the rest, and went up to the terrace. Now Queen Talata, on that day, uncertain what might befall, had made Queen Nanda and the son and daughter lie with her in one bed. These warriors, standing at the door of the chamber, called to them. She came out and said, "What is it, my children?" They said, Madam, our king has killed Videha and Mahosada and has made one kingdom in all India, and surrounded by the 101 princes, in great glory he is drinking deep. He has sent us to bring you four to him also. They came down to the foot of the staircase. When the men took them into the tunnel, they said, "All this time we have lived here and never have entered this street before." The men replied, "Men do not go into this street every day. This is a street of rejoicing, and because this is a day of rejoicing, the king told us to fetch you by this way." And they believed it. Then some of the men conducted the four. Others returned to the palace, broke open the treasury, and carried off all the precious things they wanted. The four went on by the great tunnel, and seeing it to be like the glorious hall of the gods, thought that it had been made for the king. Then they were brought to a place not far from the river, and placed in a fine chamber within the tunnel. Some kept watch over them, others went and told the Bodhisattva of their arrival. "Now," thought the Bodhisattva, "my heart's desire shall be fulfilled." Highly pleased, he went into the king's presence and stood on one side. The king, uneasy with desire, was thinking, "Now he will send his daughter. Now. Now." And getting up, he looked out the window. There was the city, all one blaze of light, with these thousands of torches, and surrounded by a great host. In fear and suspicion, he cried, "What is this?" and recited a stanza to his wise men. "Elephants, horses, chariots, footmen, a host in armor stands there. Torches blaze with light. What do they mean, wise sirs?" To this Senaka replied, "Do not trouble, sire. Large numbers of torches are blazing. I suppose the king is bringing his daughter to you." And Bukusa said, "No doubt he wishes to show honor at your visit, and therefore has come with a guard." They told him whatever they liked, but the king heard the words of command, "Put a detachment here, set a guard there, be vigilant." And he saw the soldiers under arms, so that he was frightened to death, and longing to hear some words from the great being, he recited another stanza. "Elephants, horses, chariots, footmen, a host in armor stands there. Torches blaze with light. What will they do, wise sir?" Then the great being thought, "I will first terrify this blind fool for a little, then I will show my power and console him." So he said, "Sire, the mighty Chulaniya is watching you. Brahmadatta is a traitor. In the morning he will slay you." On hearing this, all were frightened to death. The king's throat was parched, the spittle ceased, his body burnt. Frightened to death and whimpering, he recited two stanzas. "My heart throbs, my mouth is parched, I cannot rest. I am like one burnt in the fire and then put into the sun. As the smith's fire burns inwardly and is not seen outside, so my heart burns within me and is not seen outside." When the great being heard this lament, he thought, "This blind fool would not do my bidding at other times. I will punish him still more." And he said, "Warrior, you are careless, negligent of advice, unwise. Now let your clever advisers save you. A king who will not do the bidding of a wise and faithful counselor, being bent on his own pleasure, is like a deer caught in a trap.
As a fish, greedy for the bait, does not notice the hook hidden in the meat, which is wrapped around it, does not recognize its own death, so you, O king, greedy with lust, like the fish, do not recognize Julaneya's daughter as your own death. If you go to Panchala, I said, you will speedily lose your happiness as a deer caught in the highway will fall into great danger. A bad man, my lord, would bite like a snake in your lap. No wise man should ever make friends with him. Unhappy must be the association with an evil man. Whatsoever man, my lord, one should recognize for virtuous and instructed, he is the man for the wise to make his friend. Happy would be the association with a good man. Then to drive home the reproach that a man should not be so treated, he recalled the words which the king had once said before and went on. Foolish thou art, O king, deaf and dumb, that thou didst abraze the best advice in me, asking how I could know what was good, like a nether when I had grown up at the plough-tail. Take yon fellow by the neck, you said, and cast him out of my kingdom, who tries by his talk to keep me from getting a precious thing. Having recited these two stanzas, he said, Sire, how could I, a clodhopper, know what is good as Seneca does and the other wise men? That is not my calling. I know only the clodhopper's trade, but this matter is known to Seneca and his like. They are wise gentlemen, and now today let them deliver you from the 18 mighty hosts that compass you around about, and bid them take me by the throat and cast me forth. Why do you ask me now? Thus he rebuked him mercilessly. When the king heard it, he thought, The sage is reciting the wrongs I have done. Long ago he knew the danger to come, that is why he is so bitterly reproaches me. But he cannot have spent all this time idly. Surely he must have arranged for my safety. So to reproach the other, he recited two stanzas. Mahosadha, the wise do not throw up the past in one's teeth. Why do you goad me like a horse tied fast? If you see deliverance or safety, comfort me. Why throw up the past against me? Then the great being thought, The king is very blind and foolish, and knows not the differences amongst men. A while I will torment him, then I will save him. And he said, 'Tis too late for men to act, too hard and difficult. I cannot deliver you, and you must decide for yourself. There are elephants which can fly through the air, magical, glorious. They that possess such as these can go away with them. Horses there are which fly through the air, magical, glorious. They that possess such as these can fly away with them. Birds also there are, and goblins which do the like. But it is too late for men to act, too hard and difficult. I cannot save you, and you must decide for yourself.' The king, hearing this, sat still without a word. But Seneca thought, There is no help but the sage for the king or for us. But the king is too much afraid to be able to answer him. Then I will ask him. And he asked him in two stanzas. A man who cannot see the shore in this mighty ocean, when he finds footing, is full of joy. So to us and to the king, thou, Mahosadha, art firm ground to stand on. Thou art our best counselor. Deliver us from woe. The great being reproached him with this stanza. 'Tis too late for men to act, too hard and difficult. I cannot deliver you, and you must decide for yourself, Seneca. The king, unable to find an opening and terrified out of his life, could not say a word to the great being. But thinking that perhaps Seneca might have a plan, he asked him in this stanza. I got to hear the advice of Seneca. Hear this word of mine, you see this great danger, and now, Seneca, I ask you, what do you think ought to be done here? Seneca, thinking, the king asks a plan, good or bad, I will tell him one, recited a stanza. Let me set fire to the door, let us take a sword, let us wound one another, and soon we shall cease to live. Let not Brahmadatta kill us by a lingering death. The king fell in a passion to hear this. That will do you for your funeral pyre and your children's, he thought. And he then asked Pukusa and the rest, who also spoke foolishly, each after his own kind. Here is the tradition. Hear this word, you see the great danger. Now I ask Pukusa, what do you think ought to be done here? Let us take poison and die, and we shall soon cease to live. Let not Brahmadatta kill us by a lingering death. Now I ask Kewinda, let us fasten a noose and die. Let us cast ourselves from a height. Let not Brahmadatta kill us by a lingering death. Now I ask Dewinda, let us set fire to the door. Let us take a sword. Let us wound one another, and soon we shall cease to live. I cannot save us, but Mahosadha can do so easily. Devinda thought, "What is the king doing? Here is a fire, and he blows at a firefly. Except Mahosada, there is none other can save us. Yet he leaves him to ask us? What do we know about it?" Thus thinking and seeing no other plan, he repeated the plan proposed by Sainika and praised the great being in two stanzas. "This is my meaning, sire. Let us ask the wise man. For if for all our asking, Mahosada cannot easily save us, then let us follow Sainika's advice." On hearing this, the king remembered his ill treatment of the bodhisat, and being unable to speak to him, he lamented in his hearing thus: As one that searches for sap in the plantain tree or the silk cotton tree finds none, so we, searching for an answer to this problem, have found none. Our dwelling is in a bad place, like elephants in a place where no water is, with worthless men and fools that know nothing. My heart throbs, my mouth is parched, I cannot find rest. I am like one burnt in the fire and then put in the sun. As the smith's fire burns inwardly and is not seen outside, so my heart burns within and is not seen outside. Then the sage thought, "The king is exceedingly troubled. If I do not console him, he will break his heart and die." So he consoled him. This the Buddha explained by saying, "Then this wise sage Mahosada, discerning of the great, of the good, went, when he beheld Videha sorrowful, thus spake to him, 'Fear not, O king, fear not, Lord of chariots. I will set thee free, like the moon when it is caught by Rahu, like the sun when it is caught by Rahu, like an elephant sunk in the mud, like a snake shut up in a basket, like fish in the net. I will set thee free when, with thy chariots and thy army, I will scare away Panchala as a crow is scared by a clod. Of what use, indeed, is the wisdom of the counselor of such a kind as cannot set thee free from trouble when thou art in difficulties?'" When he heard this, he was comforted. The king was comforted. "Now my life is safe," he thought. All were delighted when the bodhisattva spoke out like a lion. Then Sainika said, "Why, sir, how will you get away with us all?" "By a decorated tunnel," he said, "made ready. Make ready." So saying, he gave the word to his men to open the tunnel. This is the great tunnel. "Come, men, up and open the mouth of the entrance. Videha with his court is to go through the tunnel." Up rose they and opened the door to the great tunnel which led to the river, and all the tunnel shone in a blaze of light like the decorated hall of the gods. The Buddha explained it by saying, "Hearing the wise man's voice, his followers opened the tunnel door and the mechanical bolts. The door opened, they told the great being, and he gave the word to the king, 'Time, my lord, come down from the terrace.' The king came down, Sainika took off his headdress, unloosened his gown. The great being asked him why he did. He replied, 'Why, sir, when a man goes through a tunnel, he must take off his turban and wrap his clothes tight around him.' The other replied, 'Sainika, do not suppose that you must crawl through the tunnel upon your knees. If you wish to go on an elephant, mount your elephant. Lofty is our tunnel, 18 hands high with a wide door. Dress yourself as fine as you will and go in front of the king.' Then the bodhisattva made Sainika go first and went himself last, with the king in the middle. And this was the reason. In the tunnel was a world of eatables and drinkables, and the men ate and drank as they gazed at the tunnel, saying, 'Do not go quickly, but gaze at the decorated tunnel.' But the great being went behind, urging the king to go on, while the king went on, gazing at the tunnel adorned like the hall of the gods." The Buddha explained it, saying, "In front went Sainika, behind went Mahosada, and in the midst King Videha with the men of his court. Now when the king's coming was known, the men brought out of the tunnel the other king's mother and wife, out of the small tunnel, and set them in the great courtyard. The king also, with the bodhisattva, came out of the tunnel. When these four saw the king and the sage, they were frightened to death and shrieked in their fear, 'Without doubt we are in the hands of our enemies. It must have been the wise men's soldiers who came for us.' And King Julani, in fear lest Videha should escape, now he was about a mile from the Ganges, hearing their outcry in the quiet nights, wished to say, 'It is like the voice of Queen Nanda.' But he feared that he might be laughed at for thinking such a thing and said nothing. At that moment, the great being placed Princess Panchala Chandi upon a heap of treasures and administered the ceremonial sprinkling as he said, 'Sire, here is she for whose sake you came. Let her be your queen.' They brought out the 300 ships. The king came from the wide courtyard and boarded a ship richly decorated, and these four went on board with him." This is, they've gone through the great tunnel to the edge of the river, and now they've gotten on the ships which were prepared. The master thus explained it. Videha, coming forth from the tunnel, went aboard ship, and when he was aboard, Mahosada thus encouraged him. This is now your father-in-law, my lord. This is your mother-in-law, O master of men. As you would treat your mother, so treat your mother-in-law. As a brother by the same father and mother, so protect Panchala Chanda, O lord of chariots. Panchala Chandi is a royal princess, much wooed. Love her, she is your wife, O lord of chariots. The king consented. But why did the great being say nothing about the queen mother? Because she was an old woman. Now all this the bodhisattva said as he stood up on the bank. Then the king, delivered from great trouble, wishing to proceed in the ship, said, My son, you speak standing upon the shore, and recited a stanza. Come aboard with speed, why do you stand on the bank? From danger and trouble we have been delivered. Now, Mahosada, let us go. The great being replied, My lord, it is not meet that I go with you. And he said, This is not right, sire, that I, the leader of an army, should desert my army and come myself. All this army left behind in the town I will bring away with the consent of Brahmadatta. Among these men some are sleeping for weariness after their long journey, some eating and drinking, and know not of our departure. Some are sick after having worked with me for 4 months, and there are many assistants of mine. I cannot go if I leave one man behind me. No, I will return, and all that army I will bring off with Brahmadatta's consent, without a blow. You, sire, should go with all speed, not tarrying anywhere. I have stationed relays of elephants and conveyances on the road, so that you may leave behind those that are weary, and with others ever fresh, may quickly return to Mithila. Then the king recited a stanza. A small army against a great, how will you prevail? The weak will be destroyed by the strong, wise sir. Then the bodhisattva recited a stanza. A small army with counsel requires a large army that has none. One king conquers many, the rising sun conquers the darkness. With these words the great being saluted the king and sent him away. The king, remembering how he had been delivered from the hands of enemies and by winning the princess had attained his heart's desire, reflecting on the bodhisattva's virtues in joy and delight, described to Senaka the wise man's virtues in this stanza. Happiness truly comes, O Senaka, by living with the wise. As birds from a closed cage, as fish from a net, so Mahosata set us free when we were in the hands of my enemies. To this Senaka replied with another praising the sage. Even so, sire, there is happiness amongst the wise. As birds from a closed cage, as fish from a net, so Mahosada set us free when we were in the hands of our enemies. Then Videha crossed over the river, and at a league's distance he found the village which the bodhisattva had prepared. There the men posted by the bodhisattva supplied elephants and other transport and gave them food and drink. He sent back elephants or horses and transports when they were exhausted and took others, and proceeded to the next village, and in this way he traversed the journey of 100 leagues, and next morning he was in Mithila. I'm going to end there. So the rest of the story you'll have to wait until next week to hear.